I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
it's second probably is a revolutionary moment.
Hey, how does it move?
What the creature in the rocket cylinder drove its mill. I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Creative Futurism. My name's John Best.
And I am Kevin J. Anderson, and we're here to talk about the creativity and the future in business and how technology changes our lives, sometimes improving and sometimes making things more complicated. So we have lots of ideas to share. It's just me and John today, and we'll be bouncing ideas back and forth. And we'll, if we try really hard, we can get into like a real violent argument and entertain you all.
I don't know. It could happen.
It is the afternoon. We haven't had our usual beer as we're chatting and brainstorming.
That's a good That's a good point. Let's start off with some things you got going on. So I know Avatar Dreams, which I believe we talked about some time ago on another show, that has just hit, correct?
We've got a brand new anthology that I edited with another science fiction writer, Mike Resnick, as well as Dr. Harry Klor, who is the mastermind behind the Avatar XPRIZE. It's a new anthology of all really cool science fiction stories called Avatar Dreams. And you know, a lot of people, if you're just listening to it now, you might not immediately know what an avatar is or what we're talking about. But an avatar is like a remote telepresence robot, how you can be the human operator and like be a deep sea diving robot that's in the Marianas Trench, or you can be a battlefield surgeon in Afghanistan while your physical body is back in Denver or something. And there are so many ways that you can connect human minds to robot bodies. And the XPRIZE just launched a brand new Avatar XPRIZE to develop this technology. And they came to us to put together with some of the greatest minds in science fiction, just to show off the ideas of what avatars could really do. They're not robots. They're not computers. They're an extension of ourselves. And so me and Mike Resnick and Jody Lynn Nye and a whole bunch of our other writing companions, we got a bunch of stories in there that just showcase things. And in fact, I did one, it's called The Next Best Thing to Being There, where it collects a bunch of different ideas where if you could have an avatar where other people could like basically ride along inside it, you could basically have an avatar climbing Mount Everest and you'd have hundreds of people telepresence climbing the mountain with him and experiencing that. You're a remote battlefield surgeon where if you get injured in, let's say, on Mount Everest, you can't just fly a helicopter up there with the EMT. So if you have a talented surgeon operating a sophisticated avatar body, you could take care of somebody who is injured in a very remote or difficult place to get to. And I tied those two ideas together in my story. But other people have been really interesting, disaster relief people treating Ebola patients in Africa without risking exposure to themselves. I don't want to give it all away, but this is a good batch of stories. It's called Avatar Dreams, and it's out in print and ebooks now. We have Ray Kurzweil, who's one of the very famous futurists. He wrote the introduction to it. That book is out as of like last week. And something a little bit more fun, I've got another novel that will be out by the time this broadcast lands called Uncharted. It's Lewis and Clark in Arcane America. And I co-wrote it with Sarah A. Hoyt, a very good friend of mine. And this is the adventures of Lewis and Clark in an alternate history where magic works and America has split off from the rest of the world. So it's Lewis and Clark crossing the wilderness, which is like the lost world with demons and shambling walking dead and dinosaurs and sea serpents. And just type in Uncharted and look at the cover. We've got this giant river sea monster rising up in front of Sacagawea and Lewis and Clark firing their muskets at it. So if that isn't cool, I don't know what is. So I get to, that one's just coming out and it's in hardcover or an ebook from Main Books. There's my plug. What are you up to, John? Why don't we toss it back to you? You're an awfully busy guy too.
Well, but before I go on, could I ask a question about I want to ask a question about both those books. So one question just real fast on the Avatar book. It seems like what they had you guys do was create these entertaining stories, but that also are what we call in my business use cases, right? So it's interesting that you know, Dr. Klor and yourself and Ray, you guys wrote these stories, but they're actually kind of use cases for this technology.
the average person on the street knows what a robot is and they know what computers are, but an avatar is something more subtle. And I think they wanted us to find a way to show people the potential and possibilities of this technology. And, you know, as science fiction and real science and engineering has often been sort of this circular loop that science fiction people make things up and then other people invent it and make it real. And then science fiction people make up other ways to use it that they hadn't thought of. And then they expand the technology. And so one of the other things with avatar technology is that size doesn't matter. And so if you have like this very microscopic, like a little drone, you can almost be doing remember the old Fantastic Voyage where they injected it?
Oh, yeah. You could fly a nanobot into someone's body and cure cancer, maybe.
You wouldn't need to shrink anybody down. You just have them be an avatar telepresence inside this microscopic drone robot looking at. In fact, Kevin Eikenberry wrote a story in this anthology where it's a super new strain of like the MRSA, the flesh eating virus that's mutating rapidly in a trend. The core virus, and they're flying around in this microscopic drone inside one of the victim's bodies. And that's, it's just, I had thought of that as an idea at all. And Todd McCaffrey, best-selling author, did a really short story where they're using, again, not microscopic drones, but very small drones that telepresence rescue teams are using them to go through the rubble after an earthquake to see if there are any living bodies buried under fallen buildings and stuff. So I don't want to give them all away, but they're really cool stories. And have a look.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Yeah. So my question on the second one. So you mentioned Sacagawea. So in this new world where they've sort of switched over into this parallel landscape that it is she still an Indian, or does she have like other cool powers? Like I was thinking, like Indians would turn into like awesome things.
Well, Native American magic works in this new world, what we've got. So they've got.
Ah, see, I was thinking that. That's pretty cool, man.
So she can actually, she's actually a shapeshifter, and she can turn into an eagle. And there's a shaman who is actually the manifestation of coyote. So he's running through the woods. And there's the great evil spirit that's trying to gather all of the Native American magic and turn it against the white invaders to drive them back across the Mississippi. And dinosaurs and dragons and sea serpents, like I said. So it's a lot of fun, and we hope to make it into a series.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. I think it'd make a great television show or a movie. What have I been doing? I've been actually, this month has been really difficult in the sense of travel. I have been traveling around to support my book, literally just back in from Fort Lauderdale yesterday, where I spoke at a conference, and I spoke to a lot of financial institutions regarding artificial intelligence. And something I was discussing was what I call autonomous banking, which is something you and I kind of talked about, except for you called it a preference battery some time ago. But so I've been really spending a lot of time kind of working on that, and then also working on the identity platform that we've talked about in the past, which is this idea of self-sovereign identity, an identity that only you own. And it's interesting because the news is really starting to bear this out. It's really starting to, you know, the local stories that have been on and the news that's coming out is really starting to show the need for self-sovereign identity. You know, this idea that something like Facebook defaults to saving your personal information if you don't turn it the other way, you know, and then what happened with Cambridge Analytica, which I'd like to talk about that for a second. Would you mind if I just go through and explain it, and then I'll kind of let – I want to hear your thoughts on it. But let me just run through it real fast.
But I'm going to pause you there first so that I can be your master and you be my Padawan, because one thing that you did very badly right now is you talked about your book and you didn't tell us the name of your book or what about.
Breaking Digital Gridlock. It can be found on Amazon. And currently, today, it's number 45 in Banks and Banking. So I was pretty proud of that. So I broke the top 50 of this particular like list. It's not like I broke, you know, any big list like you do. But, you know, given that it's a very specific book, I'm very happy with that. And I've got a lot of good reviews. So I hope you'll take a look and read it. Kevin gave me a great review of it. And so thank you for reminding me of that.
All right. So let's talk about Cambridge Analytica, because I find it fascinating and horrifying, and I'm sure that even after studying it, I'm only grasping the teeniest tip of the iceberg of the implications that this has. So lay it out for us.
Okay, so here's what you need to know. So Facebook has always made its money off of collecting data about its people. It's how he finally figured out, he being Zuckerberg and their group, how they finally figured out how to monetize this platform that they built. And the way they monetize it is that, you know, if, and you know this, Kevin, from your own experience, if you've been in Facebook and you spend a couple days, you know, researching something, maybe you were doing some Lewis and Clark researching. Now, all of a sudden, you know, there's Lewis and Clark books, you know, in your sidebar there. And it's, you know, it's pretty clear that the platform knows a bit about you, and what you see sort of is determined by that, whether it be ads or content.
And the first couple of times you realize that's happening, it's really creepy. That now, when I search for Lewis and Clark on Amazon, and then it shows up some other Lewis and Clark books on Amazon, okay, they know I'm looking for things. But then when I go on to Facebook and it suddenly starts giving me Lewis and Clark ads, and I go to Twitter and it suddenly starts posting Lewis and Clark things to me, that's just too big brotherish to me, because I didn't go to Facebook to look for Lewis and Clark, and they didn't go to Twitter to look for Lewis and Clark, and yet they know.
What's interesting about that is that Facebook has been collecting, you know, the details of your identity, right? So they know everything that's in your about. They know who your friends are. They know what they like. They know what you like. And the idea was to create sort of this personality trait, you know. That's really kind of the focus of it. And then use that information, as we just mentioned, to target audience with audiences with digital ads. This has been done for a long, long time. And one of the things that they have done in the past is they have shared this data. So they don't sell it or anything, you know, but what they will do is they will share this data with, quote unquote, and can you see my fingers? I'm holding up the air quotes, researchers, right? And so Cambridge, which, by the way, Analytica, doesn't that sound kind of educational? Sounds kind of, you know, Cambridge being a, you know, a big, university. And the company said that they wanted to, you know, they acquired the data for use in research, which in some ways is true. They just didn't say what they were going to use that research for. And so, you know, because Facebook actually prohibits that kind of data to be sold or transferred to any other, you know, ad network or a data broker or something. And it says that, or a monetization related service. But they don't prohibit it if you're a researcher. Let's say you're trying to, solve a, you know, like cancer or something. You know, Facebook wants to be part of that. And as long as you're using the data for good, they feel like that's okay. So with me so far, you've got a Facebook account and you've given it some data. And on top of that, they've used sort of algorithms to look at what you like and what you've clicked on, as well as where you've gone and who your friends are, to create this profile of you, this personality trait profile. You with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in comes Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica, who was hired to do this research, supposedly, they went out and they started putting out this personality profile kind of test, right? It was a personality survey. And to take it, you had to download an app. And I'm sure you've seen these before. Like, hey, you know, find out if you're a poodle, you know, an eagle, or, you know, whatever. You know what I'm talking about? You've seen these in Facebook, right? So this one was pretty, you know, it was something that they had put together. And they could download this app and they would do this personality survey. And when they did that, they would grab some private information from the person that downloaded the app. And when they ran that, they now would have the, you know, if you said yes, there was probably what we call a EULA. And EULA is spelled EULA, and it stands for End User License Agreement. You've seen these. They're really long. You have no chance of reading them all. You never do read them. You lie and you say, I agree, so that you can get to find out whether you were a poodle, an eagle, or a shellfish or whatever.
Because there's no option. You either agree or then you go home. I mean, there isn't a you agree
right
with these caveats. You either agree or you cancel the whole thing.
Well, and a step further, the important stuff is buried in the fine print of the EULA itself. So in the EULA, it does say that, hey, when you take this profile or you take this personality test, we're going to collect your personal information. This technique had been put together by you know, a guy who was a Russian-American psychology professor. And so he built his own app in 2014 and began harvesting the data for them. Now, here's the wild part. Guess how many people actually took the survey?
It's like only 20 or 30,000, right?
A little more than that, 270,000 people, which in the scope of the 5 billion users that Facebook has is not a lot, right?
Right.
So the program in the background took advantage of the ability for Facebook to allow me, let's say that you downloaded my app and you took my personality profile and you agreed. Now I can use your account to connect to Rebecca because she's your wife and she's connected to your Facebook, right? And so now I have her data. And how many friends do you have on Facebook, Kevin?
Right now, and I've got 3 different pages and it's close to 10,000 people. No, it takes like my wife's data, but she didn't take the survey. It just takes what my Facebook profile knows about her because she's my friend, my wife, right? So
right. Well, actually, it took what Facebook knew about her by going through you to get to her profile.
To her profile, not what her information was on my profile. It went to her profile and took it.
Yes. And it didn't get any sensitive pieces of information like passwords or anything. It didn't take but it did definitely get information about a user's location, like where she was. So ultimately, in the first round, they said that Cambridge Analytica got, from those 270,000 accounts, they were able to get 50 million other people. That was the first step. That was the first time when they reported on this. Since then, they've now admitted that it's far more than that. In fact, it's almost untold numbers. And the only reason we know is because there was a whistleblower named Christopher Wiley who revealed the alleged practices to everyone. So you've taken this profile, your 10,000 users have been scraped. So one Kevin J. Anderson is worth 10,001 people. That's pretty nice, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know what the average number of friends that Facebook people have?
I have no idea.
About 165. So now Cambridge Analytica has all this data. So what to do with all this data? They go through, they use the data to create this incredible psychological profile. And they're looking for people who are maybe anti-Hillary at the time, you know, election 2016, because this is being used by the Trump organization.
Right.
And to deliver, they're also looking for people who are also maybe on the fence, you know, and deliver pro-Trump material to them. Not only that, but to go ahead and create, the term has been used a lot, right? Fake news. And so if you were kind of inclined to believe that, you know, Hillary Clinton had purposely, and I'm not saying she did or didn't, I don't know, but had purposely delivered classified information, you know, across her personal emails, then you might get a story about how purposeful this was. That wasn't really true. Something like, well, you know, she purposely did this to, you know, to fund her foundation, and here's just enough clicks and links and stuff to make you feel like it's real. And since you were leaning this way, you might not even read the article. You might just look at it and decide it's true. And that may change how you think about things. Well, and it creates influence.
It's even worse than that, in that not just slanting something that's already in the news, but that in this particular instance, and again, I'm trying to be objective here, but I might annoy some super Trump supporters or something, but they would manufacture out of whole cloth stories like Hillary Clinton is running a child pornography ring out of the basement of a pizza parlor, that a simple check will prove to you that it doesn't even have a basement. So that was just plain false information that they were spreading to the people that this data set identified as might be gullible enough to believe it. And so, well, let me take one step back here, because with all of this data gathering that we have with our Safeway cards and with our Amazon purchases and with our movies we go see and what cable TV stations, we have all this data that's around there. And we know that somebody's just watching everything we do, how many Kleenexes we use a day and what kind of toilet paper we buy and all that. And I frankly don't find that all that objectionable if Safeway knows enough about me that they're going to give me a coupon to the kind of coffee that I actually want to buy. Or if they tailor their, if I'm on Facebook and somebody puts up an ad for tampons or for Pampers, that's a wasted ad for me because I have no interest in those products and no use for them. But if they tailor it and give me an ad to a new book series by an author I like, or a new a concert tour from one of my favorite groups that they know because they've seen me buy a bunch of their MP3s or CDs, I don't mind that sort of thing, although it's a little weird. What this, though, is so offensive is that they are taking this very sophisticated information and using it to deceive. And that's what the Cambridge Analytical and the Trump campaign uses were doing, that they were not just finding somebody who liked a certain brand of toilet paper. They were actively finding somebody who could be gullible and giving them misinformation to reinforce their views. And that is nefarious, if you ask me.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, is that when we use data for good, people like you are happy, right? When we use data for bad, we're unhappy. And that's true of anything, right? That's true of a weapon. That's true of you writing. You could write a book that was, you know, not cool and used, you know, to you know, maybe attack one of your other authors or something that you don't like. I'm not saying you have anybody like that. I know you're loved and love everyone, but you know what I'm saying. But let's talk about this for a second. There's some gray area there. We've had this discussion before, but what if, you know, your credit union or, you know, Ent could tell you that you have a strong possibility that you might have colon cancer based on what you're purchasing? Would you want to know? Or would you be mad that they looked at that?
I personally would kind of have a shiver go down my spine, but I'd run to the doctor really fast. I mean, that's the kind of thing where it does save lives. And one, we were talking before we started recording, this data set that you're talking about, the 50 or more million people that they're gathering data from, there is things to be learned from vast data sets that we've never had access to before. I mentioned earlier that I had read and really enjoyed this book called Freakonomics, which deals with massive amounts of data and draws very subtle conclusions that were not previously apparent. And you only get those conclusions if you have enough data. If you have 10 people that are drinking red wine, you can't draw the conclusion that drinking red wine causes heart disease or cures colon cancer or something. But if you have a 4 billion person data set, you can draw some conclusions. So there's a lot to be had from these gigantic data sets. I just really don't like them being used for political manipulation, because then where does it, we get into the fake news. Like, how do you prove anything if you put so much false information out that's targeted to people who are disinclined to double check the accuracy of it?
I want you to do something. That's exactly right. Is we're living in that world where without scale, some of this doesn't make sense. And the other thing is, who are they to tell you that? But, and maybe you ran down there and spent money on this test and maybe you didn't have it. And then are you mad? So there's so many shades of gray in this, but have you gone to the Facebook tool to see if your information was shared?
I have not. And I wanted to know how to do it. I couldn't quite find how. Well, I've heard it on the news, but I didn't know how to do it myself.
Well, this is your lucky day, because I am going to send you the link right now, and we're going to post that link on this podcast so others can go check. So I was not shared, so believe it or not. So nobody that I was related to took, and I'll tell you the name of the survey in a minute, but nobody that I was related to took this this survey, which would have then had me, you know, my information exposed. But I'm sending you the information right now, so you can check. So the name of the survey, while you look at that, if it comes into your email there, is it was called "This Is Your Digital Life." And so, and it, you know, when you check it on this website, it pops up and says, Based on our available records, neither you nor your friends logged into This Is Your Digital Life. As a result, it doesn't appear your Facebook information was shared with Cambridge Analytica by This Is Your Digital Life. I'll be interested to see what yours says. But while you're doing that, let's talk about another really useful, when you talk about the scale of data, something just happened. And today for everybody, we are recording. It's April 25th. It's about 3 p.m. What's happening right now is that the Golden State Killer, someone who committed over 50 rapes, killed 12 people, and has been sought after since the 70s, was caught. And the way this person was caught is through technology. The evidence was later on put through this massive database. And this massive database now shows that, hey, guess what? You know, if we ever have a good suspect, if we can get some DNA, we can check the guy. Now, it also allows us to catch people who've done multiple crimes. So that's how this guy was actually caught. And interestingly enough, it was a writer, an author, Michelle McNamara, who happened to be at the time the wife of Patton Oswalt, pretty famous comedian, sci-fi nerd, guaranteed. I would 100% guarantee that he is a fan of yours. I don't see there's any way he couldn't be, because I know he loves Dune. And his wife, his wife actually died overnight from an accidental, just mixing a couple of things. Not like she was a druggie or anything. These were normal drugs, but she unfortunately just had a bad reaction to it. And one night after Prince died. And but she was writing this book, and her lifelong book that she had been working on was catching this guy. And so she gave a lot of information to try, that she spent all this time researching it with all of these people who were online who also have access to databases. And so as a result, through all of this and the work and the extra attention that was brought to it, today, some, 30, 40 years later, this dude is in jail. Now, that's sad because he obviously had a lot of years out of jail, but he's still caught. And so that's a good use of this giant database with the DNA. But it's fascinating because it's sort of a double-edged sword, right?
Something occurred to me while you were talking about the Golden State Killer. When you mentioned earlier about Ant is kind of an odd connection, why Ant would tell me that I might be at risk for colon cancer. But what if this database is out there? And I get a message from the premier commercial colon cancer screening test saying, we've looked at your data and we think that you might be at risk. So please buy our test so that you can see whether or not you have colon cancer. That's kind of a different thing now, because now they're using it for commercial purposes. And how do I know that I really and truly match their criteria, or if they're just sending this to every single address saying, buy our test and see if you're at risk?
Yeah, and you don't know. And so you're in a position where you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, right? If you do and you find out it's not, okay, well, but if you don't, you have family, you have people that depend on you, Kevin. Can you really ignore that message?
If I can believe it, if it's truly something at risk, and this is another a good thing about these huge data sets, because sometimes remember it was like the mid 80s when people were starting to walk around with their cell phones, the giant bricks that they would talk into all the time. And then there was a lot of concern. In fact, I worked for a research lab that did a bunch of research studies on this, whether talking on cell phones gave you brain cancer, because a lot of people were afraid of that because they're walking around and there's radio transmissions going on. And at the time, at least, they didn't find any evidence. But now that we can have a data set of billions of people, and we know that billions of people are actually talking on cell phones, maybe we will find some subtle nuance of the data that we didn't get when the previous data set was only 1,000 people or something like that. So that's a good thing.
But let me give you a bad thing about it, though. So this is interesting. This is the actual thing that happened. I'm not going to name the family or my friend, but I have a friend. And their family recently got all excited about Ancestry DNA. I think it was 23andMe or one of those companies. You know what I'm talking about, right? So for our listeners, that's a company where you take a swab of your mouth and you send it in. And they go, ooh, based on this, here's all your family and here's all these people and all this stuff. And you're related all the way back to the Moors. And Kevin J. Anderson's actually related to, all the way back to I don't know, Genghis Khan, you know, I don't know, whatever.
Very likely.
Yeah, I was thinking that's if I was trying to pick a historical figure that reflected your views. The idea is that so I'm a family member, the mother of this family. She did this and it came back and said, hey, guess what? You have a brother. Actually, it didn't say that. The brother found it when he put his stuff in and reached out. Well, that, as far as she knew, she didn't have a brother or a half brother. And so she starts, she meets with him. Well, the DNA doesn't lie. Well, guess what? Her parents, her mom and dad, and this is my friend's mom. So he's 1 year younger. He's in my age range. He's, you know, somewhere around 42, 43. So his mom finds out that she has a half brother. Her mom and dad are still alive. And so now her mom has to face the fact that her dad, who is now like, I don't know, 89, 90 or something, had an affair.
Yep.
This whole thing is now like, and I don't know if that's good or bad, but.
This is a similar example, but it's not the genetic thing. It's a little bit more concrete. Is I like to give the example over and over again about, I hate those red light cameras that take a picture of you as you drive through. If you get caught in a yellow light or a red light or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they automatically mail the ticket to you. Right. Well, what had happened, though, was that this guy got a speeding ticket going through one of these things. And he was in the car with his mistress or somebody he was having an affair with. And so they took a picture and mailed it to his house. And his wife opened it up and caught that he was cheating on her. And they got a divorce and it ruined his life. Now, you can make your moral judgment that he shouldn't have been doing that in the first place. But is the penalty for running a red light the destruction of your marriage and the ending of your stability? I would say that went a little bit beyond what the camera was supposed to do. I just find that unsettling that, you know, if a cop's going to be there and he sees me go through the intersection when the light's red and he pulls me over, well, you caught me. But when you have like a hidden camera that's taking a picture of everything, well, that just doesn't seem fair to me.
It's interesting because the other argument would be, well, just send the license plate, right? Because they always send you that back picture where you could only see the license plate.
And then they'll say, I wasn't driving the car.
Right, right. But then they could also say, go online and look. You know, they got other ways to deal with this now. But yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's you know, that's the – you always hear – I don't know if you've ever been in a Rockies game or any national – you know, any kind of sports event where they say, oh, it's the kissing cam or we're going to use the cam. If you're here with someone you're not supposed to be with, you should leave now, you know. Because that's happened before too, right? You know, somebody's panning the audience and there's my husband and who the hell is she, you know? So.
But now this is different from your DNA example because you can stretch it and go, well, the guy really was doing something improper by running the red light and he really shouldn't have been with his mistress. But these people are just getting a DNA test trying to figure out their curiosity about their ancestry. And look at the blowback that they're getting and how many secrets have been kept in families that they secretly adopted the kid and never told him he wasn't really their real son. And now it comes out because he does the DNA. Is that really something that it's our right or responsibility to, if the parents adopted a son and they decided to claim him and never tell him that he wasn't their real son, is it ancestry's responsibility to ruin that kid's perception of himself? It's morally ambiguous to me.
But I could take the devil's side to say that kid found out he had some unusual disease and he needs to find, he doesn't understand. Nobody in the family's ever had it. You know, I mean, we're unraveling things right now that are so, there's so many ethics and morality issues around it. It's crazy. It's just crazy because the tech just this quickly has gotten ahead of us. And, you know, AI is going to be right behind it with this. And it's you know, this is like every book you've ever written come true very quickly. And it's amazing to me how fast it's descending on us, you know, that I would know someone that was in this situation and that, you know, that this wasn't like the, you know, the Target ad where, you know, Target told the dad that his daughter was pregnant, you know, before he ever knew. This is, you know, someone I know. This isn't a one-off, you know, somewhere in another city. This is happening all over. So yeah, it's pretty crazy. And And I find it fascinating that you were actually caught up in the and you didn't even do it. You weren't the one that took this is your digital life test. Someone, and here's the worst part, you as a public figure, you had so many people that were related to you because, you know, you're an author, and this social media platform is a great way for you to interact with your fans. And because of that, it only took one person out of that 10,000 for your information to now wind up in the Cambridge Analytica.
Well, database. It says, however, a friend of yours did log in. I don't know if that specifically means only one out of my 10,000 people did.
They put it this way. Notice they didn't tell you who the friend is because they don't want you going and getting mad at them. You know, I don't think they would even.
I have lots of friends who do the, you know, what movie star do you look the most like? And if you were a constellation, what would you be? And all these kind of things where I just kind of slap my forehead and go, who has time for all this stuff? But a lot of people do. And a lot of it is even, my wife plays an awful lot of the Facebook games or the micro game, even Candy Crushes and all that.
Yeah.
And they all collect a lot of little information. So it's getting out there. And this is a topic we discussed earlier about your, the credit bureau reports being taken about the secondary questions, you know, what's the name of your dog and what's your favorite pizza topping and stuff that they can use as the secondary.
Well, no, actually that was the one where they use your credit report and they say, okay, Kevin's owned three houses in his life. So I'm going to give him a question that says, which of these addresses did you ever live at? Two of them, one of them's right. The other two are just random ones, maybe even pulled from other people. And, you know, going from there. So, yeah, it's interesting, you know, to think about all that data going away, because now what's left for me to identify?
But it gets back to with my Facebook profile page, all the stuff on there, like you said, you can probably figure out what my favorite color is or the names of my pets or the high school I went to and all of these supposedly verification questions that used to be only kept. And would know this, but now with a little bit of data mining, they can find these sorts of answers from a lot of people, which means that we're going to the core of your identity kind of needs to be you. It needs to be my fingerprint, my DNA, my retinal scan, something that another person can't copy because they know the answer to my favorite pizza topping or something.
And eventually it's going to be, instead of even knowing that stuff, it's let me check directly with Kevin. And there are ways to do that now. And if Kevin doesn't answer, then we're not letting you in. So if we don't hear from Kevin that we know is Kevin and it's not you, and that's the new world, right? That's the passwordless self-sovereign world that you and I have talked about. But let's shift gears. We're going to come in towards the end here, and something super exciting is about to happen, which I'm super excited about. And also, we just interviewed Jake Thomas, who was a Marvel editor, which was a really just fascinating interview. For those of you who are listening, if you haven't heard that one, go back, find it on the website, creativefuturism.com. Really cool to hear Kevin and Jake go at it, talking about, you know, the Marvel universe and just universes in general and how to keep them in sync and parallel universes and all that kind of stuff. It was just mind-blowing. But anyways, so I would argue that the number one, you know, nerd fest superhero movie that everybody's been waiting on is the Avengers Infinity War, which comes out tomorrow, I believe. Like tomorrow night, it'll be sort of the first showings that you can go to, correct?
So everybody will see it by the time they hear this podcast.
Yes. So we could spoil it all because they called you and you wrote most of the script, right? Is that how, I think that's what you told me.
Yeah, right. That's why I'm up at the cabin. I'm hiding. You know, everybody's excited about this movie because it's kind of like the whole gangbusters thing. But let me step back. If you remember back that, like, the Universal monster movies back in the 40s that they had Frankenstein and Son of Frankenstein, and they had the Wolfman, and then they did the team up Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and then they did the House of Frankenstein, which, like, brought all the monsters in there, and then you had the Mad Monster Party, which was even more of all the monsters, and they threw them all together.
Right, the Godzilla fights, you know.
Yeah, and then it was Godzilla, and then Godzilla versus King Kong, and then all of the Japanese monsters fight all of the other Japanese monsters. And that's sort of what we're getting at with Avengers and Infinity War. I just want to make one comment that people probably throw Rotten Tomatoes at me or something, because I'm a little bit concerned with this one because it is everything thrown together. We were just in Hollywood for a big writing awards ceremony, and we were on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's this gigantic billboard for Avengers Infinity War. And I took a picture of it and I posted it on my Facebook page. And I forget what the number was, but there are on this poster for the movie showing the stars of the movie, there are like 38 figures crammed there. And I said, this is like a crowd shot at a cosplay convention. And my concern is that there are so many people in this. How are they going to give anybody more than 2 minutes of screen time? As you know, it's going to be like the mad world of superhero movies, where everybody gets this little cameo for a couple of minutes, which could be fun. As a writer, I'm a little bit skeptical about how they make a meaningful story out of it. Are they going to break it up into seven teams with 20 people each of them? Maybe, I don't know. Or maybe they'll just focus on Tony Stark versus Thanos or something. Again, you will have all seen it by the time you're hearing me probably say things that are entirely wrong. I had concerns with the previous one, Avengers Age of Ultron, because it just seemed like a blur of, now who's that one? Oh yeah, I remember that hero. Oh, and there's another one, and there's another one. And it didn't feel that the story was as strong. Now, Rebecca and I just watched, we're late, I know, but we just watched Thor Ragnarok, which we thought was quite fun because it really does focus on maybe like a half a dozen of superheroes, and they all got to have decent amount of time, and it was entertaining. I worry about Infinity War having so many people. Do they even all get a line? And we'll see. Well, it's certainly, they're investing in it because I believe this is the most expensive movie ever made. I think it cracked the $1 billion budget when they throw everything in. It's two movies, I guess they broke it up into. But
wow. Well, you know, from what I've seen, based on how they're doing this, it looks like it, to me, it looks like it follows this, similar to what you were just saying, the mad world, right? So, you know, you pat your page from, hey, I was just talking, you know, we were just watching Buddy Hackett, and God, I'm dating myself that I actually can name the people in this movie, but I love that movie. It's probably one of my favorite movies of all time. And Phil Silver's going this way, and then 2 minutes later, you got whoever the other two that, you know, the other teams that are together.
Mickey Rooney was in there. The Three Stooges had a cameo. Jack Benny, I think, had a cameo. Like, everybody who was a comedian at that time they had to be in that movie. No, right. It's a great movie. I just rewatched it with my parents about 6 months ago, and we laughed all the way through it.
Winters, you know, Spencer Tracy is the lead, you know.
Yes.
Serious movie.
Yes. So we'll see with Infinity War, and it gets me though in the same way that Avatar did, is after you watch it, you come out, go, all right, now where do you go from there? And when I made this concern on my Facebook page, somebody answered me really well, and it kind of changed my mind a little bit. And their response was, this isn't just a giant brawl gang shot movie with everybody in it, because Marvel has been building up to this with movie after movie after movie after movie for whatever, the last 15 years. So it's not like they're just throwing it all together. This is, we, the audience, have been primed for Infinity War by watching all of the Iron Man movies, all of the Thor movies, all of the Spider-Man movies, all of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. And so we're friends with all of these people. So it'll be like a high school reunion with a big bad guy.
Yeah, that does make sense, because you would think, oh God, we have to go through and tell this whole, you know, story. And really, that's not true, because we've learned about the Infinity Stones one by one. You know, in fact, there was a mention of it in Thor Ragnarok, right? And it's kind of funny when the lady's walking through the vaults underneath Asgard, and you know, she's like, oh, crap, fake. You know, she's walking by. But that was an important little piece that you probably need to remember for this next movie. So the early reviews are very positive. So I don't know. I'm excited. So when you go, do you like dress as one of the superheroes?
My schedule is so busy, I'll be lucky to go before it gets to Redbox. So the only thing that we do make an effort of seeing on opening night are the Star Wars movies. And the superhero movies I see when I can, but I will probably not see this one for a week or two after it's out. I might not even catch it in the theaters. We just, like I said, we just watched Thor Ragnarok and it's been out for 6 months. So I watched the Justice League movie on the airplane from Wales that I was coming back on the other day. So
I still have not seen that and I want to.
Well, just lower your expectations and you might have fun with it. So, all right, that's another entire show to talk about. In fact, that might be a good one to compare the Avengers Infinity War with Justice League, because they're both big team up movies, and we'll see where they go from there. And in fact, this ties together with our entire thing, because what do all superheroes have? Secret identities.
And they wouldn't want their DNA getting out because they drank a Coke at the scene and somebody found it. And now we can say, oh, well, we know Spider-Man's Peter Parker. We have his DNA.
Well,
and now we can make another Spider-Man.
And we're going to, that's another whole thing about your privacy. Like who owns your DNA? Because obviously you can say you don't want to have a test, but if you drink a Coke and throw the can away, well, you've sacrificed your DNA. And then another question might be, who owns my voice? Because a voice print can be used as an identification. So I'm speaking. Does that mean that I gave rights to my voice to anyone who happened to record it? He said, looking at his podcast microphone and wondering what he just got into. So anyway, that's more stuff for us to talk about. Obviously, we have plenty more. The world is changing, and we're going to try to keep at least one nano step ahead of it. So I think this kind of wraps up another episode of Creative Futurism. And I'm Kevin J. Anderson.
I'm John Best. And we're out.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, go to creativefuturism.com. Thank you.